This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
I'm Andrew Johnstone, and you're listening to The Last Breath, a podcast about death and dying, brought to you by Hospice Waikato and Free FM, the Waikato's community access media organisation. Prostate cancer is one of the leading causes of cancer death for New Zealand men. Mal Brooks is 81 and living with advanced prostate cancer, and I cannot begin to express what a privilege it was to sit with him and be witness to his heart.
My name is Mal Brooks. I'll be 81 in 3 weeks' time. I am going through a period of prostate cancer. I was born in Devonport on the ship HFS Philomel, which I understand is still the basic name of Devonport, in 1945, after my father came home from the war with all the other soldiers. We moved from there to a place called Tūrua. And I can always remember, I was young enough then and old enough to remember my father getting his first job in the cheese factory there, very small cheese factory we used to operate. And I think it was the third day we were there, the Catholic minister came round to see us as a family, and my mother wouldn't let him in. And the reason was that because we didn't have any furniture, but my father pulled out a couple of beer crates and we all sat on that. And I had a bit of schooling, a couple of years schooling, growing up in Tūrua, and then we moved to Horatū because my father got a job as a fitter and turner at the AFCO freezing works. Before the war, he was in the Air Force, and he learned to do some fittering and turning, repairing our old aeroplanes and stuff like that. And then he moved down to Christchurch and qualified as a full fitter and turner in the railway workshops. We're down there with the big trains used to run for the South Island. Before he met my mother, and he married her before we left for the war, and then came back and conceived me.
So your father had a very special job in the war.
Yes, he could speak not good Italian, and that was learned from neighbours in Christchurch when he was living there who were Italian immigrants, and because he was young and they had a couple of boys who still spoke, mother Italian from them. So the army had heard that he had disability, and they asked him if he'd join the army and go away overseas in the 1st Expeditionary Force in the 27th Battalion, which he did. And most of his first part of the war was in Libya when it was annexed by Italy before the start of the war. And they would have to go up to the odd forts on the deserts and everything, which were manned by the Italian soldiers. And he would stand up outside his and call out in Italian to surrender. And he telling me, in those early years, I did ask him, why didn't they shoot you? And he said, they never shot back. He says, they just walked out and threw the rifles down and gave up. And he says he found out that they didn't want to fight in any war. So after that, he went back to Māori camp with the 27th Battalion and went through the series of the war into Italy before he came home. My mother was at Devonport and the end of the war. And she was one of the many people that were repairing the ex-army surplus clothes to be drafted back into the army for other soldiers and young boys like me would wear for basic army training. So we went to Tūrua, as I told you, and then we went to Horatū and he had his job. I did schooling at right up till I left at Horatū. Lucky to be ducks at the school, and I wondered what a ducks was when they told me all about it. I thought, well, I'll get a duck, but, it wasn't one of those. It was a D-U-X one. From there, I went to what was then Hamilton Technical College, which is now Fraser Tech, and did 4 years college training there and managed to get university entrance. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I was a freelance. I was a little bit wild. I loved playing rugby and cricket and chasing girls. And I went to Auckland, and I thought, oh, I'll try to go to Auckland and get to university. And I didn't last long in university. I found it very, very strange for me, being part Māori. It was a completely different world. And I sort of copped out and eventually went back down here to Hamilton and got a job in an architect's office who had two or three other craftspeople there and one other architect who virtually started off training me to be in the construction industry and draw up drawings for plans and all that kind of thing.
Now, can I just ask you about, you said you're being part Maori, you didn't fit in at university?
Oh, I felt I didn't fit in.
Why is that?
Oh, I suppose it was the first time I realised there was a racial slur. And I couldn't handle it, personally. It kind of frightened me. I was the only Maori there, or with Maori blood in me there. At that time, obviously, there were others there. And others, obviously, had been before me, too. But at that particular time, with that particular year, I was the only one there. So it was a visual thing only, you know, and I didn't talk about it. Other people looked at me as though, oh, you're different, but you're not, but you are different looking at you. Yeah. So, and it kind of stunned me. So I thought, like, this is not for me. I wasn't perhaps strong enough mentally at that age then to cope with it, put it away. So, all right. So I worked for these architects for quite a number of years and different firms in Hamilton. Waikato Hospital Board was one. Our firm had run out of work, so they sent me down to the Waikato Hospital Board, who then, in those years, had their own architects and engineers. And I sat next door to a guy who had a beautiful writing and sketching abilities. And he taught me a few things about drawing. And for 6 months while I held that job, and then I worked for another firm called Galloway's, and I noticed actually some of their stuff, and I was involved in it as an Waikato Museum. Actually, I only found that out about a year ago. There's archives or the architectural works and buildings that were built in Hamilton. And I proceeded on with that, and then the associates and the bosses of that firm retired, and we were wondering what we were going to do. So they offered two of us if we could stay and be part of an associate firm. I wasn't too sure. Well, we were both unsure, actually, but we did. We stayed there for a while, but we weren't very successful at getting work and stuff like that. So eventually he left. I stayed and started my own business. And by this time, I was getting up to, say, 1974, 73, 74. And started work on my own and found a lot of builders came to me and wanted this done, wanted that done. And it was virtually the self-employment start for me for the rest of my life. I didn't even have to advertise, which was, I thought, quite good. And from there, my life just formed and I did work. And socially, I got to know other people. I got to know some Australian hierarchies, you might call them, in the freight forwarding business, who employed me to go to Australia to do some design work and construction design for them, which I did in Perth, Sydney, Tullamore, the Melbourne airport, and the new one that was built at Perth, and Ascot at Sydney. And then they got me to do some of their office blocks and that sort of thing. The good thing about that is I remember that for a couple of years, I used to have to go and prepare a report and go to the boardroom, and it was generally on Fridays. And Continental Airlines were running that day, and they were the biggest freight carriers for Continental Airlines, and they used to get me what they call as a staff ticket, which cost them $100, which was in those days, and that's return, and that was first class. First class was full, I'd go to business class, if not, go to economy. If the plane was full, and it never was, I probably would have had to walk. And I would get that, I would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, be at the airport, the plane would take off at 6:30, quarter to 7, and I'd arrive in Sydney at 10:30. The board meeting would be at 11, we would have lunch at 12. I would be back on Qantas QF51 in those days at 1:30 their time, get back to Auckland, and I would be home at 8:30 at night. Yeah, I always thought that was wonderful. I did that about 3 or 4 times. I remember one particular year. But they sold out to eventually to Airborne, who was a Canadian big firm in the world at that stage doing freight with Maersk. And I became still friendly with the board members and everything, and used to be invited over to some of their parties for their weddings and things like that. And used to meet them sometimes in Hong Kong. Hong Kong was still, under UK territorial kind of thing. And I remember we used to have a lot of fun in those years about that. And then they all faded away because they were another era older than me. Yeah, but very, very nice people, excellent people. So I did travel after that around the world quite a bit for a number of years. I ended up in, which is today UAE, United Arabs. I understand and looked at the photograph, it's completely changed now. I wouldn't even recognise it. Doha in the early days, where there used to be sand up the street instead of steel and concrete. I did work in Malaysia for a firm. Then eventually got across to the States, managed to get a work permit there through some, and ended up in Hawaii, staying with a very nice Hawaiian firm who became really like family to me, and I was part of their family, and did a number of jobs for them. A little story offside on that, one of their child, and he was big as a door, huge man, huge Fijian, and he was worked for Hawaii 5-0. And he rang up me up from home. I was doing some work for the Black Construction. And he says, I'm coming to pick you up. I says, what for? He says, I'm going to take you something. You want to come and see this bloody mess? And the mess was Marcos from the Philippines had been ousted, obviously, from the Philippines. Everybody realised in that era. From the riots and stuff, and him and Imelda had hopped on a plane, and America, because America had decided to take him in because of the war years when he was in charge of and helped the Americans in the Philippines. And they landed the plane at right down the end of a runway, I think it was a Pearl Runway they called it, and he sat outside the fence, he drove up on the fence, he said, look at this, and there. They were unloading the plane very close to the fence, and I noticed all these crates. I said, what are all these crates? He says, US dollars. And some of them were half broken, and there were dollars going all over the bloody tarmac. And, you know, some of the people inside there were trying to clean it up and pick it all up. And he said, this is what I wanted to see. See what this man's done? Yeah. I said, one of the interesting sort of points that I always remember. It was quite a stunning thing to watch and look and know about it in history. So that was that. But then my mother got a little sick. She had a very bad heart. And she rang me up in Hawaii and said, can you come home? And I said, yeah. So I came home and looked after her for 12 months. And I lost my jobs and everything in Hawaii by then. So I decided to stay in Huntley, where she lived, and she was born there, actually. And I didn't like it for the first year or so, but then it grew on me.
So why did you decide to stay in Huntley, of all places?
I was half broke. and I didn't have a job because I'd lost it, you know. I didn't know the dole existed in City Me. Yeah. So my money had run out, what I had in the previous year. So actually a builder from Huntley called Jack Thorburn came and saw me, and he says, I said, oh, you can draw my plans up for me. And that was it. So, yeah, I started drawing plans up and everything there. And then a lot of other people come along and, you know, sort of earned my keep from then on, from Huntley. Yeah.
So you didn't like it the first year?
No.
What didn't you like?
Oh, I think I was missing the lifestyle that I had beforehand in Hawaii and stuff like that.
So what kind of life were you living in Hawaii?
Beautiful. Yeah. I used to start work at 6 o'clock when I worked for Black Construction. Black Construction was eventually bought by Fletcher's here. I used to start work for them at 6 o'clock and finish at 3. And then we go play 9 holes of golf and go and have some cocktails after. It was just fun. Yeah.
And did you meet nice women in Hawaii?
Oh, definitely. You know, there were lots of things to do. One of the members of the family looked very much like me, my colouring and height and build and everything like me. And he was a colonel in the army. And he used to give me his army card, which I'd pluck on here. And I'd go to the local golf courses where a tourist member had to pay $120 to get on the course to play 9. I paid 10, and I used to give it back to him at night and everything like that. However, when 10, 11 came along, that stopped all that. No security stepped up and nobody would be able to do that. It's just one of the funny things to get away with. Yeah.
How good were you at golf?
Oh, I got down to, over there, got down to a 6 handicap. Yeah, we had a kind of a family membership thing we used to go and play for. It was a lot of fun. The golf courses in Hawaii are very beautiful, lovely. You know, the people that run them are beautiful, which are mainly Hawaiians, like Hawaiians. And military own a couple of nice golf courses there, Pearls too. So him being a colonel and whatnot, I used to play there for nothing with him. Yeah, and then go into the officer's mess and have a few cocktails and everything. So it was that kind of life, you know, and the weather and the swimming. I didn't take up surfing, was never a very good surfer, but I used to go swimming a lot.
So Huntley's a big contrast.
Yes, yeah, and I sort of had a little trouble handling it for a while. Yeah, and I did meet a lot of my old friends that I'd met previous years when I was in Hamilton. And got into them, and they gave me a few jobs and whatnot too, and used to put me in contact with people who needed jobs done. So virtually I've been doing that right up until last year. It's been my working life doing that, yeah.
What about your personal life?
I had an affair many years ago, had a child, boy. And unfortunately, we had to adopt them out. Kind of a racial slur thing again from her parents. And I was still having a hard time handling that type of thing.
So I take it she was Pākehā?
Yes.
And they didn't like the fact that you were Māori?
No, definitely not. Mm. She was a nurse, and he worked as an engineer down south at Te Anau on the, what was the boat's name, Whenuapai, Whangarei, the boat they put down in the lake where the staff used to stay, Whenuapai, yeah, it did service during the war too.
Anyway, that was when they were building the hydro
dam, the tunnel.
They all lived on the boat.
Yeah. But they eventually moved to Australia and took him there. However, the rule was then that I couldn't go and look for him. It was illegal for me to go and look for him. I did make a few inquiries, but then I was told, no, you can't. It's the rules, because you adopted them out, you cannot. But he could. And he did. And he found me.
So you'd been thinking about him all these years?
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah. How did he find me?
How did he make contact?
He made a few inquiries. He was going with a partner who was a librarian at the university in Brisbane. And she asked and queried him about, you know, your father and blah, blah, blah. And she told him, he told him what happened. And she went and saw the adoptive parents that had brought him up. And they said, yes, he's in New Zealand. We weren't told his proper name or anything like that. Okay. But he made inquiries. She did. And then she found Professor Truer from the university here. And by instinct, she rang him. And he says, yes, he says, I know that gentleman. He says, he lives in Huntley. He says, it might not be him, but you can take a chance. And she rang me and spotted me. I nearly fell over. Yeah. So 3 weeks later, I went over to Brisbane and contacted. Yeah. So it was the beginning of me having a family.
What was it like to see him for the first time? What was it like to see him for the first time?
Oh, I cried. So did he. So he'd had an affair and had a child, a girl. So that was my first granddaughter.
What was his name?
Cameron Bell. And if I give the spot to them, they'll know. And then she eventually, and she's had three children, so I became a great grandfather. And then he had an affair with another girl. I don't know why we never ever got married. We had affairs. And had another boy, and he's now 8 years old. Yeah, but unfortunately, he passed away a year ago from cancer.
He was 51.
Yes. He, not like me, he didn't look and stay until hopefully die without pain. He had a take your life arrangement, which he wanted. So I did go and see him, talked about it. That's what he wanted and that's what he did. And the whole family's happy with that. He was in sheer pain. Sorry. However, his granddaughter came to my 80th birthday party at the Rangiriri Hotel, 3 weeks off a year ago now, and I was surprised and brought over a little new girl she had bred from her partner, also called Coco, a girl, lovely little girl, baby girl. So, that pleased me very much.
So you... After your mum died, you're a man on your own, and
yes.
And suddenly, a few years later, you walk into a family.
Yes.
And how did that change your life?
Well, quite dramatically. I kept thinking about them every day, and I still do, from the start. Yeah, it's wonderful. I'm glad it happened. I did almost got engaged once many years ago with a girl I fell in love with. But unfortunately, and I don't know why, it seemed to follow me around, was she passed away. I only had 6 months with her. Sort of knocked me around. kept me away from girls for a while. But anyway, came back. Time does good things sometimes. I had a, prostate cancer. I had a 2019, I had a PSA test and it was getting high from my normal PSA number, and the doctor told me then, he says, I think we better get you up to the oncology and see what's going on. So I had a couple of appointments up there and they checked my flow and all that sort of thing. And then he said, well, about 6 months later, he said, better send you in for a biopsy. So I went for a biopsy, and it was getting close to 2020 then, I think. And it wasn't there. They said it's clean. So, but he says, we want you to, your new doctor, to manage and give us PSA tests every 2 months, I think it was, or like that. And he says, we could do it, but you can arrange it with your doctor. And I said, I know, the doctor and I will do it. I think that was the worst decision I made, because I forgot and went on when you're doing things and excitement makes you forget a lot of things. If I advise anybody who says that, always get the hospital to give you PSA tests, because they'll more or less forcing you to do it, not relying on your memories and you forgetting. So that's something that somebody can learn about. Anyway, the second one showed up as being positive, and it had got quite aggressive and gone to my bones. And they said, because of my body, and I suppose a lot of other bodies that people own, was kind of breaking down because of age and other elements in inside you. Kidneys weren't that good and heart wasn't that good. And they said, we don't think we could give you any chemotherapy and probably knock you around too much and you wouldn't survive on it. So I said, well, what else can I do? They says, we can just monitor it. And once the pain starts coming, is to monitor and try and keep the pain down with radiation, which in the last year I've had 4 radiation treatments. And then I started to deteriorate. Other things started to happen to my body. I was getting pain in with my cancer. So they were giving me drugs. And then last year, about June or July, they put me on some drugs that sort of kept the pain away for quite a while. But it didn't last, like most things, forever. And I got quite sore and everything, and the district nurse advised me that I should go to hospital. And I said, didn't want to. And she says, well, I'll put you into the hospice here at Waikato. She says, they're very good. And I heard about hospice. In fact, I think about 10 years before, I came to see a friend who died one day after I saw him here. And I think funny part about it, this is a story I'm going to tell you about, in this very room, same unit. And he passed away anyway a day after I saw him, and he had prostate cancer. So that was about October, November last year, and I was here for a week or so. And they managed to get my, try some drugs on me and manage the pain very well, which I was able to go back home and with health care looking after me for 3 days, you know, with showers and stuff, and being able to do a bit of work still. It carried on a little bit. And but then at the beginning, just before Christmas, I got very painful again. And again, my district nurse advised me, says, I think we'll get back. I could get the ambulance smell and get you. But then half an hour later, she rang again. And she says, I can get you back here and get them to monitor you again, Mel, to see what's going on. So that's how I ended up here to this day. And hospice is very, very good. It's a beautiful facility. It's not a hospital, actually. It's a resort hotel. The meals are lovely. People are lovely. The doctors are excellent in explaining exactly what they're going to do, why they're doing it, and how they're doing it, which I find very, very good because I ask a lot of questions sometimes and don't get a lot of answers. So, but here at the hospice, you know, it's excellent. So I advise anybody. Sorry. Who gets to my condition? Follow the same pattern. Excuse me. Right, now my pattern now is that by early next week, I'll probably be able to go home again and be relatively pain-free, take my drugs. But it's not going to last forever. So my next plan will be to get to a home after a few months and start the end of life there for me. And well, that's the arrangements we're making anyway.
How much time do you think you have left, Mel?
6 months.
What are you feeling at the moment?
Emotional. I'm an atheist, but I am spiritual. I've kind of very much love life tremendously. Like everybody else, I made a lot of mistakes, but a lot of good things too. If I ever come back, I'd always go back to be a caretaker of people. That's what I meant. Just a rubber on it.
What do you mean by caretaker of people?
Oh, anything simple, even like an ambulance driver or pediatric or first on the block to look after somebody.
You want to
even
help?
A doctor. It doesn't have to be a doctor because you got to go through all those exams and stuff that they do. You know, even if it's a lower scale. Yeah, I would do that. What do I know? And what I've seen. And there's not enough of them around. On the sort of voluntary things, I always like to do things voluntary. I've done a lot of jobs voluntary for different things, different people, different institutions in my lifetime. And always enjoyed that without getting paid. And people say, no, we'll pay for it. I says, no, I did it for my enjoyment. So I always like that. And done quite a bit of that. Should have done more. But you do other things as well in life. And you got to do other things in life.
Could you, so you're an atheist, but you're spiritual. Could you tell me a little bit more about what your spirituality means to you? And
Well, I have high regard for other cultures, other, you know, spiritual things that they do, other religions. I know people need something to the reasons why they're here and how they can stay here too, right? You know, because a lot of religions believe in life after death and that kind of thing. I don't. But I respect people who believe that side of life. And I believe that's a spiritual side of life. And my spiritual is not believing in that, but it's hard to explain. I've always thought, on my Maori side, the spirituality's been there, but haven't quite known what to do with it. Put it that way, a bit hard. I know there are other people, and they're very good at, even some ministers and stuff I've met, who at people's deathbed have softly put them away, which I think is very good. Taking their probably mental pain away from them, you know, which is part of what I worry about sometimes, because my brain's still working too well. Not so bad, I suppose, for people who, you know, partially are getting dementia and stuff like that, and the cogs and the machine up here is not going too good. That's a different kind of pain, I think. Mine's physical pain, like a lot of others play it.
Can you describe the pain to me, Mel, as best you can?
My own pain? Mm. My pain's contained where the cancer is, in the bottom part of my vertebrae. My last scan, which they wanted to have to see if it had jumped up into the top part of the vertebrae, but it hadn't, so that was good. So they gave me my last radiology treatment last year, about November, I think it was. They gave me another scan after that to make sure that it hadn't gone up the back, and it still hasn't. I have a little bit under the bottom rib here, and one other around the hip side here. But they are stagnant, they haven't grown at all. They said the only dangerous one is the one I've got on the lower back, okay? And that's the one that'll kill me. Hmm. Yeah, because it can't stop that from growing at the moment. It's just under pain management, so it's still evolving, doing its thing, yeah.
Do you feel the pain all through your body when...
No, my pain's in the lower body, around the girth, as they call it. Yeah, around the hips, and back part and bottom part of my body. It'll probably move down to my legs, but the upper part of my body is okay. Yeah, can still talk, operate, eat and jump and whatnot, yeah.
So when the pain's really bad around the lower part of your body, is it unbearable?
Just about. Yeah. Just about. I think they call it on a scale of about 8 out of 10. Yeah, and I've had it once or twice. And they've given me special shots of steroids to bring it down. And it's worked.
So when you take painkillers, is it intravenous or oral?
Oral, yeah, tablets, yeah. Yeah.
And do you have to take those every day?
Definitely 3 times a day. Yeah, heavy dose at night so I can sleep. And I'm sleeping, you know, a bit like that. Being a facility like this, you can doze off during the day to catch up, I suppose. That's what I do. And the nurses here monitor me and watch the time clocks and everything when I'm supposed to have that medication on time. So the clock ticks around in the body and takes over from the old pill that's dissolved. They're what they call slow dissolving pain killers. Yeah, they're on a 12-hour shift like that. Yeah, there was one that they were giving me which almost supposed to be instant. It didn't work for me. And they said it's quite often like that, different people type of bodies. Yeah. So that's about my journey to the stage.
So on top of all that, you're faced with the fact that you're going to have to leave your home.
Yes.
Can you tell me how that's making you feel?
Oh, I always been a homeboy. I think I can put up with that. Over my lifetime, I've kind of lived and slept and eaten in a lot of people's places, and stayed at different places. So, yeah, I've slept on floors and chairs and whatever, wherever I had to sleep. I think I can handle that okay. Yeah. Yeah. Boredom will be my biggest problem.
So what do you do in the normal course of a day to keep yourself occupied?
At the moment, I'm watching television. I have been reading, but I find my reading novel that I find, and I've read all my life, you know, books and things. I've always been interested in things. And I'm kind of losing that ability, yeah, to do that now. I'm starting to get more happy to sit here and the television give to me what they know, and I know a lot of it's lies. I'm kind of relying on that at the moment. Yeah, but I think still about going back to the book now and again, so I should read another couple of chapters. And maybe when I get to a home or something, I will force myself to do that. Yeah.
What do you like to watch on TV?
Documentaries. Animal Things, Attenborough. Yeah.
On that subject,
yeah.
Before we started recording, you told me about your dog.
Oh, my dog, yeah.
Could you tell us that story again? Because that was really beautiful.
My friend brought a dog home from the rescue pet shop in Hamilton. And then she kind of got a job that she couldn't look after it every day. So I looked after it. So it became my her dog sort of deal. He was a Labrador collie. And I can remember the first time we took him to Te Rapa on a training course. It was a Sunday morning, yeah, and he went apeshit. Couldn't handle it too well. But anyway, we put up and went back three or four times, and his behavioural patterns became really good. And being around us, because I was always an animal person, and she is too, he learnt all to go to the neighbours, and neighbours knew him, and half Huntley knew it on the first stage, or at that stage. And actually at the Kimmy home, it used to take it to palliative care side of the hospital, because there were a lot of farmers, you know, and they missed their animals, and we used to take them in all the rooms in there, and they used to love it. And in fact, a lot of them used to have red biscuits ready for them, and used to jump on their bed and the kind of deal. But unfortunately, that only sort of carried on for about 12, 14 months. And they got a new manager, and some new rules came in, and we couldn't take him there anymore. Okay. So he was a partner to me while I was working. He would be under my feet, and exactly at 4 o'clock he would bring his lead in for me to take him for his walk around the lakes. Yeah. So, and then he got sick and had to decide to euthanize him. And I contacted the vets, and they said, "Don't worry, Mel, we'll send two nice, lovely blonde vets around here to help you," which they did. And half a Huntley came to see him put down. They dug the holes and everything, and I spent the whole bloody afternoon making sandwiches and cup of teas for all the visitors to come to see him to get buried. And I said, in the end, thanking them all, I says, Jacko, my dog, probably have more people at his funeral today than there'd be at mine.
Why was he so popular?
He was very popular.
Why?
Oh, kind of half-human. Used to go down and see the local mechanics down the shop there and sit there, and they all knew him, patted him and everything. Exactly at 3 o'clock, he'd go down and pick up the work out of times for me. And Jack Tenney, he was there, he'd pull the times and put it in his mouth, and he'd come home and give it to me. And he'd kind of dog like that, you know. He loved to play around with other dogs. Had a cat, and the cat used to sleep with him.
What was the cat's name?
Yeah, you got me. It's not that long ago either. Short memory. Sorry, just can't remember when. It'll come back.
So I guess when he was euthanized, it left a big hole in your life.
Yeah. Still today, still thinking about him. And I've spoken to other dog owners and everything, and they have the same. Still remember their dogs. And I do too. Yeah.
You said you have good days and bad days, you know.
Oh, with my cancer?
Emotionally.
I suppose. I guess the sickness has brought that on. Sitting here, I actually have no pain. Right, just here at the moment. If I move, I have a little pain. But just sitting here, down, there's no pain whatsoever. Emotionally, hard for me to get depressed. I do get depressed like anybody else, but only for very short periods. I mean, I don't know whether you'd call it depression or not, but I have a little tear sometimes. Probably things I remember that happened. And that happening, I think, kind of made me think of life. Sometimes I get depressed about that. And it's not to do with me, it's to do with other people. It's happened too. Friends I've known, you know, kind of like that. Yeah. Thinking myself, no, I wouldn't want to die like that. So that way. Yeah. I've had a good journey. Enjoyed it.
But you're just not ready for it to be over.
Greedy I am, aren't I?
Are you experiencing any fear?
Not much. No, I haven't actually. I've thought about that actually, now you couldn't question me about it, but no, I haven't the fear there. I just know it's going to happen. I don't know whether it's that fear or not. If you know it's going to happen.
You said before that you're spending a lot of time now reflecting.
Yeah.
What are you reflecting on? What are you thinking about?
The things I could have done better.
For example?
Oh, children. I've never ever tried to hurt people, but, and I can't think of anybody in my memory that I, in my lifetime, that I have, except when it did come time to maybe marriage. Yes, I did hurt a couple of nice ladies.
You never wanted to get married?
Yeah, I did. But kind of life took over as an adventure, and by the time I realised it was getting a bit late, I forced that lateness to stay there and not bother about it. That's what I did. Yeah. Instead of still having a go. What do they call it? Second chance. Yeah.
Is it, do you have regrets about that?
Do I have
regrets?
Yeah, I think so.
If you could do it again, you'd do it a bit differently.
Yes, definitely. Probably do a few things differently.
What else would you do differently, Mel?
Well, I would pick a career. Definitely. Instead of what I ended up doing, as I said before, I'd go for the caretaking side, paramedics or something like that. Yeah. It was quite funny in my early days when you're going to school, you career officers and that type of thing weren't around. Yeah. You know, the teachers may talk to you about it, but very briefly, but left you or maybe your parents talking to you, which you didn't want to believe too often, about what you wanted to do. Yeah. At one stage, I thought I'd like to go to the military. Because I was in the ATC in the Tirapa base for a while when there was a supply base there. I think for about 18 months they used to have an ATC squad there. And, you know, we were schoolboys. Yeah, and I used to go there every Saturday morning. March up and down like a soldier and do other things, yeah. They used to, you know, teach us about aeroplanes and flights and get us to work in the stores, yeah. And march and everything on the discipline side, obviously, for soldiers and whatnot, yeah. But I enjoyed that too. But that was disbanded.
So you've got regrets, but what are the good things? What are the things that you're really happy about with your life?
The enjoyment you're talking about? I've had good adventures. I met some excellent people. Haven't met too many not presentable people. Been lucky. Yeah. I think my career choice is probably the best thing you could explain. I could explain that as far as missing out on that. I think I could have done better. Much better. And if I had a second time around, I'd make sure that wouldn't happen. I'd pick something that would, I'd be satisfied 100% and help other people. That's me.
And of course, there's the discovery of your son, meeting up with your son.
We're here.
That's one of the great joys of your life.
Great joys, yeah. Yeah.
And the grandchildren?
Yes, lovely. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, yeah, still a very big part of my life. And she sends me texts or rings me up once a week. Definitely see how I'm getting on.
So your family's away though, they're in Australia.
Yes.
So you're on your own basically.
Yes.
Is that hard?
Yes and no. The yes part is being away from, I would love them to have a home with me. But the second part is because I've lived on my own most of my life, I've been able to handle it. One of the things that I've always noticed about myself is I hardly ever notice loneliness. I don't know, it's something to do with my brain, I think, or something like that, but I've always been able to entertain myself satisfactorily. You know, even by, it's like reading books, watching television, watching those documents, reading documents and stuff on television, I enjoy still. So many things out there that you don't know about, millions of things. And other things that you missed out in life, you think, oh, I didn't know you could do that, you know. But, yeah, I've always noticed that about myself. Even I had once, and I got a bit depressed about it. I remember that. When what happened was I ended up in a Brisbane motel, hotel, and it was hot, hot, hot. And the air conditioning broke down over the whole hotel, and the heat was tremendous. And I was sitting at the edge of my bed, and the sweat was just pouring off me. And I thought, what the devil's going on here? And I thought, of all the other things and the people I knew and what I was doing, why I was there, I wanted to know why I was there. And it's the only period of my life I've ever thought of loneliness. I did. My body felt as though it went zap like that, and everything's gone. What am I doing? Yeah, but I eventually went downstairs and stayed in the foyer, and about 8 hours later, it was all fixed up and everybody went back in their rooms and I was okay. Yeah, strange. But things happen like that, I suppose, to everybody. Yeah.
Before I get, this is one important thing I want to ask you, but before we get there, when Cherie here at hospice phoned me up and said, would you come and talk to Mel?
Yeah.
I said to Cherie, what can you tell me about Mel? And she said, I don't know. Mm. So the first thing I did was Google you.
Yeah.
And I came across a story.
Yes.
You were reunited with your brother,
yes.
Raymond.
Yes.
But 2020. 20. Would you be able to tell me that story, Mel?
Okay. I was sitting home doing some work and this phone call came and I answered it, and it was this Sergeant Fred, somebody from the Tikiwiti police station, and he says, are you Melville Philip Brooks, my whole name? And I said, oh, I hope I'm not in trouble. I says, yes, it is. He says, you have a brother? I says, did have a brother, I think. I says, I haven't seen him for many, many years. In fact, last time I said I saw him was a child. He says, can you remember his name? I says, yes, Raymond Naru Brooks. He says, there is a Raymond Naru Brooks sitting in my office at the moment, and he is looking for you. Oh, I said, unbelievable. And I said, how did he end up there? He says, he landed Christmas Day, 2020, and immigration looked at him and asked him what he's doing here, and he had a New Zealand passport, and he said, I'm coming home, and he says, I'm going to find my brother. And he said, what's your brother's name? And he gave the name, and they said, oh, okay, we'll pass you over to the police, they may be able to find you for them. But they couldn't, at that stage, they couldn't find me, who I was. So they put him into a motel for a couple of nights, came back to see him, and he says, can you get me a train, maybe so I can go through Hamilton and see if I can find my brother there. So they said, okay. So he got the train. He remembers passing Te Opiri Mountain, and he looked at it and he recognised it, and he knew, he says, I have whānau there. He forgot or didn't get off at Hamilton and went on to Tikawhiti, where the station master or the guard person of the train come to see him and says, oh, Mr. Brooks, you're supposed to get off at Hamilton. This is Tikawhiti. He said, we'll put you off here and see if you can make some arrangements to go back to Hamilton. Well, they put him down on the seat there, and family walked past, and they were the Bell family, who I knew. And I think it was the granddaughter of one of them went up and asked, this brother. Are you all right? Can I help you? And he says, I'm looking for my brother. And gave the name. And luckily, her sister was a policewoman there, and she rang her. And she came down to the police station, and she says, I'm going to ring my boss to try and find your brother. And that's how the phone call came from Fred, Sergeant. And so I said, oh, I can't believe it. I said, I'll come up and get him. And he said, no, you won't. He says, I will bring him to you, which he did. So when we met, it was a very emotional time. He looked exactly the same as when he left when I was 11, 50 years before. He recognised me straight away too. He had dementia, and that was one of the reasons why he wanted to come home, as well as having a kind of a financial problem with getting accommodation for senior people in Sydney. And all his mates that he had worked through while he was in Australia had passed away. So he was getting lonely, I think, and wanted to come home and pass away at home, I'm sure. So he stayed with me for just over 3 months, and he had dementia then, kind of thing. I had to put notes around, you know, turn the water off, turn the jug off and that type of thing. But, you know, we got on quite well. He told me a few stories that he could remember about his lifetime after he left the Air Force, and he was overseas for those 50 years. And understandably, all over Europe, into Germany, because he, I think there's a story somewhere about him taking photographs of the Berlin Wall being pulled down in 1991, is it, or 89. And he took photographs of it, apparently. And little things like that. Anyway, he had to go to hospital. And they says, he'll have to go to a home. He said, we can't do anything for him. One day I was up there seeing him, and a nurse came along to see me. He says, your brother. He says, we have an Italian nurse on working in the ward. And she came up and she was talking Italian to another person in the ward. And your brother answered perfectly Italian back. And then she looked at him and spoke to him in Italian for about 10 minutes. And I says, well, that proves he must have been in Italy sometime. By the time I got to the ward and the nurse got back to the ward, he couldn't remember a thing about the conversation. And that's how bad his dementia was getting then. So that's sort of one incident or a couple of little things that I know what happened to him. But he must have had an adventurous life in what he was doing. He did get married but didn't have any children, to a nurse in England. And then he ended up in Germany, and after Germany was in Australia, got a rigger certificate apparently, and went rigging for a number of years. And then slowly got sick and the dementia took over. And I had to put him in the dementia home in Cambridge, and he passed away 10 months later. And it was a little difficult time because it was in the COVID time, and, you know, only could get certain times into the home to see him and that type of thing. Yeah. So,
was it a satisfying time of life?
Yes.
To reconnect?
Yes. I'm pleased he came home. Personally, it cost me a lot of money, most of the money, but I didn't care. He was home.
And he got to die in safety?
Yes. And he was family. So that's what you do.
Mel, this has been a beautiful time to share with you.
Thank you.
But before we go, I just want to ask you, do you have any wisdom you want to share? Wisdom you want to share, the meaning of life. which is probably the hardest question of all.
It is. You're looking at some of the purpose of life. Who was that comedian that did that silly thing? I feel about the purpose of life. Can't remember. it was a comedy thing about the purpose of life. I suppose it's very hard to, as a purpose of life, it's very hard to, when you're younger, to think about and what you want to do about your purpose of life, except selecting whether you want to be a doctor or whatever like that. I don't think that's a purpose of life. That's a thing you just want to do, right? I think the biggest purpose of life for a human is probably to look after each other. Don't be lonely. Don't be aggressive. Be happy. Hug your own. I've never thought of it that way, but I kind of done things that way. Doing longings, hugging people. Always been into that. Mother might have taught me that. She was like that. Because we do tend to follow other people's habits, don't we? The only advice, as you said with that question, is just try and have a happy life. I think that's all you can do. We can plan things, but plans go B, plan C, plan X sometimes before you might get happy, you might want, you know. It's hard to plan. You'd have to be lucky if your plans worked out for your whole life, wouldn't you? Something always goes wrong. But you can adapt and take that wrong call out and carry on.
That was going to be my last question. And then I remembered a question that I wanted to ask you earlier on. So we'll make this the last question, if that's okay.
Yeah.
I've really enjoyed spending this time with you, and I've seen some wonderful qualities. What is the best part of Mel? What are your best qualities, Mel?
I always feel sorry for other people. So I suppose it comes from the heart. Where else would it come from?
You have empathy.
Yeah. I love people. Love animals, love birds. Love insects even. I realised early in my life that everything, small, big, mammoth or whatever in this earth, belongs here. It has a place for it. It does a job it has to do here. And that's including us humans. I don't know whether we do a good job or not. Yeah. Thank you for the interview.
Thank you for letting me share this time with you.
I've enjoyed it. I remember it. Thank you. I said to my adopted boy this morning, I says, remember me? Because I says, you're going to have to do the same thing with your brother, with your mother. It'll be your responsibility. And I think that's another big thing. We have our responsibilities. What we've got to do, whether we like it or not. Anyway, thank you very much for this. As I said, I've enjoyed it. I'd have cried a lot and cracked a lot, but I hope it does give some other people some inspiration. What can happen? All right.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.